Welcome, everyone, to the A Better Way to a Podcast. We are your hosts, Jordan and Andrew, and today we are joined by the esteemed sociologist, David Yamani, as we venture into the ever-changing and nuanced discussion of the transformation of America's gun culture. Professor Yamani is the curator, I would say, of what we've come to know as gun culture 2.0, the concept of gun culture 2.0, which is essentially how gun culture has moved mainly from hunting and collecting firearms to now self-defense, owning guns as a hobby, and the tactical world of gun ownership, really. David has gone from owning zero guns to owning quite a few guns in his journey, and covering the reasons behind that, the ever-changing and nuanced environment that gun owners kind of live in and exist in, and has a new book coming out that we're going to talk about. Thank you for joining us, David.
I'm really excited to be here. Thanks for your interest in my work, and I'm looking forward to talking more about not just the work, but also the ideas and the realities that I try to understand better, which you all try to understand better as well.
Absolutely. We are huge fans. What I'm not a fan of is using a teleprompter for that intro. That was absolutely it was going way too fast, and then I ended up having to ad lib.
You kind of lost it.
Did you hear me kind of lose it in the middle
good.
There?
No, it sounded good.
No, I didn't add ums and uhs and like panicking into the teleprompter prompts, but that was a good shot. I commend myself for trying something new on the air for the first time. But yeah, David. I've been following your stuff for a while. Actually, I have one of my favorite gray t-shirts that used to be your shirt that said guns are normal. Normal people use guns. The letters have completely faded off over the three or so years that I've had it, I think. But the spirit is still there. It's the only plain gray t-shirt I own, and I know exactly what it's supposed to say every time I wear it. And I loved that shirt. I wore that until the letters were barely legible. Because I love the message. It's something that I think so many gun owners have been saying for years and trying to convey to our non-gun owning family, friends, and whatnot. And it's just so hard to put into words with so much emotion in the argument today. So I really love that you've taken an academic approach to doing so, and you have personal experience from the quote-unquote other side. That help you kind of build bridges and lead the way through the exploratory nature of becoming a gun owner and the reasons behind it. So huge fan, super pumped that you're here.
And yeah, thanks. That phrase there was something that just kind of came to me, and that came out of a conversation I was having with a friend of mine now, Sean Sorrentino, who's doing a podcast, and he was saying, you know, what's something that surprised you after your 5 or 6 years of studying guns? And the first thing I said was, you know, that gun owners are people too. And I felt like if you just read the academic literature on guns and gun owners, you see so much of the downside and the negative side of guns and gun ownership. That simple statement, which, you know, it makes sense to anybody who's involved with guns, actually kind of resonated. And then I thought, you know, how could I sort of turn that into just, you know, it wasn't meant to be a slogan that I would put on t-shirts, but it was meant to summarize my understanding of the reality of guns. And it, you know, but it does, I think, work pretty well both as a slogan and as an empirical observation.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. I know I'm biased, obviously, as a gun owner, but at one point, like what I like to say is at one point, none of us were gun owners. So we all come from somewhere, and regardless of somebody's background, I didn't grow up with a conservative background. My first introduction into guns was joining the military, which is historically kind of conservative, but I got out and my politics didn't change too much. I think I was a little more right leaning, and I've actually come farther left since owning guns. Which is not a conversation that you really hear too often on the internet. And you said you're a self-professed liberal, and you like to use that word. You don't think it has negative connotations, which I commend you for, which is with the toxicity in the political kind of arena nowadays, in people adding their own flair to these different words. It's I'm sure you've heard them, you know. Mm-hmm. It's something that I feel like we need to kind of come back to and own labels like that, because they're supposed to mean something. They're supposed to stand for certain beliefs. And when you can say that you are a liberal gun owner, that should mean something. And I think it points to the nuance of the situation that it should have.
Yeah. Well, and I see I have much more gray hair than either of you, and probably to most of your listeners, but this does go back to when I was in my youth and, you know, politically active, and, you know, George Bush, the father, you know, accused Michael Dukakis, the Democratic candidate, of being a card-carrying liberal, as if that's some kind of slur. And, you know, those of us who were liberals at the time thought, and what's your point? You know, yeah, we are card-carrying liberals. We, you know, have a certain set of beliefs that animate our political work. And, you know, so I've never thought of myself as other than liberal, but of course, you know, the world also changes around you. So, you know, as I get older and younger people who are, you know, I think now may fashion themselves more as progressives, you know, they kind of come in on the left flank. I used to be on the left flank, and, you know, now I feel like I'm still the same, but I'm kind of being pushed more like center left as opposed to, you know, the far left that I thought I occupied when I was in college. But, you know, I think wherever I get pushed, you know, I still do think of some of those values, the importance of, you know, civil rights, and the importance of the government playing a role in ensuring people's civil rights. And if the government won't do it, then we have a legal system that should help to enforce that. You know, some concern for marginalized populations in the country. Now, to me, like, you know, if you want to call me an idiot for believing those things, that's just where I'm at. You know, it's not you, but, you know, as you said, there are slurs that people will use, like
Republicans.
Yeah, you know, right. And now, you know, I feel like I sometimes get it. I certainly get it from the right of me. I also sometimes get it, you know, from the left of me. I say, like, I'm just, you know, not progressive enough, but I'll hold up my own, you know, particular beliefs I think have stood the test of time.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that those are core beliefs that I think most people will find that, like, most Americans believe in that stuff. I don't think that those are, like, controversial things to say.
Yeah. I think, you know, there's legitimate distrust in government from both sides, you know, and so I recognize that there's an aspect of my liberalism that I do look to the government, to at all levels of government, to, you know, try to fill in the cracks where communities might need help, or to try to you know, offer defense and support and those kinds of things. And, you know, if someone tells me, hey, in my community, we don't trust the government, I'm like, well, you know, you have a reason to believe that, right? That people believe in conspiracies, in part because there have been conspiracies, and the government isn't always on the right side of history. So it's kind of a critical engagement, I think, but recognizing in the big picture, you know, our you know, government has worked to try to have the country live up to some of its values.
Yeah. You know, and I come from conservatism, and then libertarianism, and then now kind of like left libertarianism. And so the whole idea, at least as I learned it, and it's changed a little bit now, and kind of it's like you said, like, you kind of stay the same, and then you get pushed around on the spectrum because, you know, the demographics of your little corner of politics changes. But as I learned it, you know, there are, like, basic civil and human rights, and the government's main job is to ensure those rights, you know. And from a libertarian perspective, it's like the government shouldn't do much more than that. But, you know, you can certainly make the case from wherever you are that, you know, whatever distrust you have of the government, the idea is that we want the government to be more trustworthy. You know, we want to be able to entrust the government with these things that, you know, these guarantees that are important to us.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Agreed.
Now, what do you say to people who would say that because you are a gun owner that you shouldn't call yourself a liberal, because the Overton window keeps shifting, and we're constantly being told what we're not. Right. Just in our space that we occupy,
we're disqualified from.
Yeah, which is it's funny to me because I don't even know what I am. I know what I believe. I don't know what that makes me necessarily, but we'll constantly have people tell us that, you know, we're not left enough, like you said, or coming from conservatives, they'll literally call us communists for believing in gun rights for everyone and things like that.
Yeah.
But what would you say to people who think that gun ownership is a partisan thing, and that by you owning guns, you can't call yourself a liberal?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'd just say that, you know, if you break down the, and there are many ways to slice the data pie, and I'll try not to go on too much, but, you know, one way of doing it is looking at people's self-professed political orientation, liberal, moderate, conservative, and then, you know, what portion of the gun-owning population falls into each of those categories. It's about 40% conservative, 40% moderate, self-described, and 20% liberal, right? So the majority of gun owners consider themselves either liberal or moderate, even though the face of gun ownership is very profoundly conservative.
For sure.
So, you know, I think it's in part just a misunderstanding because of all of the biases that exist in terms of what we're exposed to.
Right.
People who are liberals, just liberal gun owners in particular, just don't have as big a voice and as big a platform. And the other side of that, I would say, like at the level of political elites, that, you know, guns are a hugely partisan issue, that since 1968, gun control has been part of the Democratic Party's national platform. And since the 70s, gun rights have been part of the Republican Party's national platform. And so it is a political wedge issue in that sense. But I think it's the wedge is not so much about guns, because many liberals and many people who support gun control are gun owners. The wedge is really how much should guns be regulated, right? And so, you know, that's one distinction I'd try to make, is, you know, that there are many people who are liberals and own guns who also say, hey, maybe we should have more gun regulation. And then this gets us into the entire history of the country, which is, you know, not, you know, guns, gun rights or nothing, but it's been a constant balancing of respecting the right to own guns and how much can we regulate guns. And that pendulum, you know, swings back and forth. Sometimes we're in phases in which regulation is declining, and sometimes we're in phases in which regulation is increasing. And, you know, that struggle is just part of what it means to be part of a massive, diverse, democratic political system.
Yeah. I think that people lose track of perspective over the course of longer periods of time, because
people don't.
We're goldfish. We watch the news, relatively speaking, you know, we don't take into consideration the last 100 years. We really look back the past 4 years, and that's maybe 8 if you're really taking a step back. But
yeah, it's difficult to feel the emotional impact of political debates that happened before you were alive, unless you have like a deep cultural tie to those events, right? So like gun owners that are very dedicated to gun ownership and gun rights feel very strongly and are very knowledgeable about the whole debate going back the last 100 years. But gun owners who don't make it a part of their personality, or people who are, you know, philosophically opposed to gun ownership, they don't really think about things that we were talking about before our lifetimes.
Yeah. You know, I am a big proponent of kind of trying to kind of occupy a middle ground, to try to get this, you know, people to speak to one another civilly and these sorts of things. But I know there are some veterans of decades of gun rights work, like someone like Michael Bain or a Tom Gresham, you know, and they look at me like, well, you're just a baby in this. You didn't even shoot a gun until, you know, 2011, when you were 40 years old. You know, we had already been fighting for gun rights for 30 years before you even thought about it. And so, you know, they're a little bit sort of more jaded about the possibility of having, you know, cross-party dialogues and about compromise and about civility. And, you know, that's not my orientation or disposition, but I can totally respect people who have been doing this for a long time. And you know, a lot of the things that are happening today are things that they've seen happening before. So to Andrew's point, like that, knowing that history is really helpful.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, you can like respect where they're coming from and why they've arrived at this sort of like entrenched point of view, while also acknowledging that, like, that's not, you know, that kind of defensive posture is not really gonna help us make progress. You know, it might like slow the advance of gun control, but, you know, it seems like the struggle right now is more cultural than it is legislative.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah. And, you know, there's lots of things that I, you know, see them, you know, posting on social media that I, in my view, I'm just like, well, that's not helping going forward. You know, I understand where that anger is coming from, but, you know, I'm here, you know, trying to make for a better future and, you know, not forgetting history, but also not letting it hold us hostage.
I think a lot of the, I think a huge part of the problem, any real problem in today's like culturally significant political landscape, is a lack of perspective. And that's why people kind of become entrenched in their views, is that they haven't really ever taken the time to consider, or if they have tried, haven't given the opportunity to talk to someone who is reasonable enough to give them the time. Because a lot of the times we base our opinions on people who are yelling at us, not the kinds of people who are coming to us in good faith and trying to convince us that what they believe is a perspective that should be considered, even if they're not trying to convince us that they're right, but say, hey, you know, this is something that I don't think you've really gotten a fair shake at. Maybe take a look at this information that I have and then come back and talk to me. And I have one specific argument that you, or well, talking point that you mentioned in your book, which is called Gun Curious and comes out in June. You should absolutely pre-order it. I have a huge amount of respect for the way that you're doing this, because this is, you do it in a far more eloquent way than I can. And I've been trying to do this for a few years now. And every now and then we have a breakthrough and we have conversations on a very, micro level with people where, you know, we get positive feedback, like, hey, your attitude towards the situation and your willingness to talk to me changed my mind. It gave me the opportunity to calm down, verify what you were talking about. And I look at things a little differently now, which is great. The way in your book that you are able to put into words these like incredibly complex arguments that people have been arguing about on the internet for years and even before the internet, I love you. You mentioned how you don't have much to lose from an AR ban. Do you have an AR?
Yeah, his and hers. Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
In our
awesome
family.
I was going to say, if you don't have an AR, then of course you don't have much to lose, but that's, you don't have much to lose from an AR ban, but you also recognize that it won't do much for gun violence prevention. And I think that's something that with your background and with your ability to kind of reach across the other side and talk to people, is an argument that might, and hopefully, will reach more people than people like us who at face value people look at and they're like, oh, well, they just, it's a gun page. Of course they're going to be telling me that. Mm-hmm. And, it's something that I've been arguing for years and I haven't, you know, showing FBI crime stats and talking about, inner city gun violence and everything, you know, from that point of view. But, it's refreshing to read that coming from you also and having the data to back that up, because I don't see somebody looking at your book and reading your book and actually absorbing the information and being able to refute it any further or logically.
Yeah. Well, you know, thank you for those kind comments. This is a chapter in the book that I actually, as I say, kind of in the chapter, is one that I had thought about just eliminating from the book entirely, because the issue of AR-15s is so fraught. And I thought, you know, there's nothing I really can say that is going to move the conversation forward because people's reactions to the issue are so visceral. But then, you know, I thought it's one of the most common questions I'm asked from people who are outside of guns and gun culture is like, why do civilians own AR-15s? And I think it's a fair and legitimate question. And also, you know, I think that the pain that people associate with those firearms is also legitimate. And so this is where, you know, I try to kind of upfront, like, acknowledge the fact that these things are done in our society that are absolutely horrific with these firearms. And so I can see totally why people would say, just get rid of them. There's no reason to have them. But, you know, that's not, I think, what a considered investigation of the reality of AR-15s and the big picture of firearms says, right? Now, there are people who will respond to, you know, your point, Jordan, that they'll read the chapter and say, I don't care how few, you know, deaths and injuries are caused by AR-15s, how remote, you know, the chances are of a school shooting or a mass shooting, what positive and productive purposes to which people put them. I just don't like them. And I don't think, you know, people should have them. Right. And you can't argue against that.
No, but that's
valid. At least it's like, you know, you've surfaced, okay, it's not about, you know, the data. It's not about the pros and cons. It's you have a distaste for these firearms and what they stand for and what their potential is.
What
on
was
the
it
negative
that,
side, and that's it.
What was it the governor of New York said? I think she's the governor, Kathy Hochul.
Yeah,
she said somebody was there was some like new gun regulation being proposed, and somebody was like giving her some statistics about, you know, why it might not work, and she's like, I don't need the numbers, okay, I don't need statistics and facts to know that we need more gun control here in New York.
Yeah,
I remember that. That was, and I think that was after the latest Supreme Court ruling.
Yeah, the Bruin.
Yeah,
but yeah, so it's really indicative of that kind of frame of reference that you're talking about, where you can't use reason to change someone's mind when they didn't use reason to get to where they are.
And I think this is profoundly important and on both sides, because I'm an empirical social scientist. I mean, I've spent my whole life learning how to collect and analyze data, and, you know, my whole career is based on that. And yet there's an important aspect of our cultural conversations around guns that they are not empirical conversations, that you know, we know from social psychologists like Jonathan Haidt that, you know, it's our, you know, he has this analogy of the elephant and the rider, you know, and we think of the rider as in control of the elephant. If the rider is reason and the elephant is emotion and intuition, you know, that it's the rider is not in control of the elephant, except sometimes, right?
Yeah.
You know, what drives us in our thinking and our understanding really is a lot of intuition and emotion, and that sometimes we can find ways to make reason work. And so I think, you know, that's really affected the way I think about engaging people on the issue as an empirical social scientist, not to think, here comes the Trump card, I'm going to lay down the data and resolve the argument, you know, but really listening to people to understand where they're coming from and figuring out, you know, places where some empirical data would be useful and places where that's not going to be useful in terms of moving conversations forward.
I'm sure that if you're listening to this right now, you know how difficult it is to find factual, non-biased, and non-sensationalized information regarding the gun community and the things that actually matter to us. I can't tell you the amount of times I've gone to look something up, whether it be an event in the gun community, some bill that is proposed, or something new in the firearms industry, and I have to filter through somebody's politics, personal beliefs, and all that garbage that is getting in between myself and the information that I am looking for. It is truly exhausting sometimes. That is why we are excited to tell you about this episode's sponsor, The Reload. The Reload is where you can find non-sensationalized, fact-based reporting on issues relevant to gun owners. I subscribed after our episode with Stephen Gutowski, the founder of The Reload, and haven't looked back since. It's been an invaluable resource to me as somebody who wants to be plugged into this stuff but doesn't have time to go through 20 articles to sift through the bullshit. Whether you're serious about this stuff or just casually interested, as a gun owner, you want to make sure you have the right information. So go check out The Reload at thereload.com/ABW2A to save 25% on a subscription just for listening to this podcast. All right, that's it. Enjoy the rest of the show.
Do you feel like familiarity is a large part of it? Because I felt for a while that, like, from the anti, and not from like liberals or the left or whatever, but just from people that are like anti-gun, like as like an identity anti-gun, I feel like there's this like moral kind of imperative to not know things about guns, right? To just not know anything about guns, and if you learn about guns, you're like tainted.
I mean, I think that there is some of that. There are some people who know some things about guns. You know, we might think of them as being, you know, FUDs or very bought into gun culture 1.0. They know a lot about certain aspects of guns, which they think of as being legitimate, and they just have a distaste for, you know, guns that don't fit what they think guns should do. But, you know, I think there is an element of lack of experience, I guess, so to speak, that, you know, if your entire understanding of guns is based on the harm that they've done either in your community or that you see it doing to other communities, then that's the only real data you have to draw your conclusions about guns. And so,
yeah,
I think for a lot of people, so let me just give an example. So in my sociology of guns class at Wake Forest, the first thing we do before we even meet in a classroom is go to the gun range. And given my students' background, about 2/3 of the students have never really shot guns before. And so we go to the range, they have an opportunity to shoot a 22 Ruger, a 9mm Glock, and a AR platform rifle. And so for many of them, it's their first exposure to guns, and it, you know, it doesn't revolutionize the way that they understand guns, right? If they come into that experience having a sort of negative orientation to guns, that's not overturned, right? If they're obviously, if they have a positive orientation towards guns, that's not overturned. But what it does is it kind of softens the edges, you know, so the people who were sort of anti-gun going in, they say, well, I don't love guns, but I understand why other people might, or I understand why someone might enjoy doing that, or I recognize the power in that weapon, or I recognize that it's not as powerful as I thought. If they're shooting the AR and like, oh my God, I don't have PTSD now just because I've shot an AR. So
that's a deep cut.
You remember that one?
Yeah, like that one guy.
Yeah. So I think that's the thing. It softens the edges. And if we can soften the edges, then that gives us an opening for education, for conversation, for progress in, you know, kind of mutually understanding where people are coming from.
Yeah, absolutely. I think doing this stuff in person is obviously beneficial because you've got that element of, you know, you've got body language, you've got, you know, you can read somebody's the way that they're speaking that you can't do online. When you start spitting facts on the internet, people read that as being condescending, and which rightfully, you know, that's a reasonable take because so many people are. One of the things that I remember you saying in your book was you made the comparison between guns and alcohol, and mention that for as many problems as we have with alcohol, guns are significantly less of a threat. And I love how you mentioned San Francisco specifically. You said San Francisco finally got rid of their last gun store. And when you looked up how many liquor stores there were over 800 with more opening every day. Mm-hmm. Yet when you bring up this point with people that, you know, as dangerous as guns can be, there aren't that many negative outcomes in comparison to something else. Gun control advocates typically accuse us of being callous and uncaring, and even more so as to say that we don't care about kids and things like that. I'm sure you've heard all of that.
Oh, yeah.
Even if it's a legitimate question, But how do we refocus people on a perspective like that in order to make that push towards a more informed decision on what we should do with guns? And I agree with you. Trust is a huge component of that, and it's hard to do that on the internet.
Yeah.
But it seems like such an insurmountable task to get people who are arguing emotionally to come back and say, hey, look, these are two things that are big problems, but this is so much bigger. Why are we focusing on this? It's like going to the ARs versus handguns debate.
Right.
You know, if gun control was a big, if we focused on handguns, it would be a significantly bigger impact than ARs, but that doesn't seem to be the push. How do you think we should go about doing something like that?
Well, I think to go back to your first point, the it's really difficult to do this all through face-to-face conversations because it's not as easily scalable. But there are so many limits to trying to have these kinds of conversations in, you know, online media. And, you know, one of the things that is a huge benefit of doing my class is the face-to-face dimension. And, you know, there's constantly people like, oh, you know, could you broadcast that, you know, could you record it and make it available, or could I sit in? And, you know, my answer is always no, because as soon as there's a camera watching a group dynamic, then people are now then all not just conversing with who's there, but also performing for who they think may be listening in on. And so, you know, everything that happens in my classroom is totally closed, you know, specifically in order to encourage these kind of conversations. And I think, you know, when we take up this issue of the parallel between guns and alcohol, the danger really is this kind of whataboutism, right? That you're just like, oh, let's talk about the negative outcomes with guns. You're like, no, let's talk about alcohol. But, you know, that's, you know, and I think that's bad just to kind of divert attention. So, you know, how you bridge in and how you use that other example, I think matters a lot. And I think what it's to say is that, yes, rightfully, we should be concerned about negative outcomes with firearms as we are with negative outcomes with other things. And yet somehow our concern with one is greater than our concern with the other, despite the imbalance in the harm that they cause. And boy, the, you know, you want to talk about harm, the intersection of guns and alcohol is a lot of where the problem lies.
Yep.
you know, so I think it's just that it's kind of that certain people kind of give themselves a free pass on the alcohol side and they spend all of their time in the critique of the gun side. So it's, you know, not to say that neither one of them is a problem, but really to say, hey, let's look at the ways in which we tolerate a certain amount of negativity in our society because we like alcohol, right? And also because we found that if you try to prevent people from accessing things that they like, that you're just going to cause more problems, right? And so the parallel to guns, I think, is pretty close to the same, right? People want guns. You know, people have good reasons for having guns. People use guns responsibly, and some people don't, just like with alcohol. We've tried to ban alcohol. If we try to ban guns, it's going to be the same set of unintended consequences happening because of it. So it's I think, again, it's the internet reducing things to the kind of whataboutism. If you say, oh, well, but what about alcohol? If you're on the internet, it just goes off the rails at that point. If you're talking to someone, you could say, no, that's not what I'm saying. You know, I'm not saying that, you know, let's talk about alcohol and not guns. I'm trying to draw a parallel between these two.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is a huge component of it that, you know, we were talking earlier about if people don't like guns because of emotional reasons and they just don't like guns, then that's fine. My wife and I,
you shouldn't argue with them about it.
Exactly. Or you can't refute that. My wife and I have a mutual friend. She's actually the mother of one of our mutual friends who we also hang out with. Very, very liberal, very anti-gun, and from an emotional perspective. And she wanted to have a sit-down conversation with me and talk about guns and my perspective on gun violence and gun control. And I set up this whole presentation. I researched statistics. I went all the way back
to
square
one.
Oh, you
really did, huh?
Oh, yeah. It was like I was prepared for a 3-hour dissertation on why gun control doesn't work. And we had this conversation, and I was over there for probably about 3 hours, but it was more of a conversation. It wasn't me just talking at her. And at the end of it, she said, well, you know what? I just don't like guns. I just don't like guns. I don't like them, and I don't think anybody should have them.
So and what did you want to talk about?
I said, I almost said her name. I don't think she'd care, but I said, why didn't you just tell me that in the beginning? I wouldn't have done all this stuff. I would have just, you know, accepted that, and we could have had some superficial conversation. But I think that is what a lot of people kind of fail to come to terms with on the anti-gun side of the debate. And I think likewise, a lot of people on the pro-gun side of the debate
don't
like people who are anti-gun. They have these preconceived notions of them, and they won't admit that, no, I regardless of what you say, I'm going to disagree with you because of who you are and who you voted for.
Well, not just that, but it's like, you know, there are definitely people that if you could, and I don't think you can, but theoretically, if you could
thought
prove
police.
Like this kind of, yeah, just sorry, like don't cancel me, guys. If you could prove like, you know, the prevalence of guns in this society is making things worse, and you could show it to them, so it was irrefutable, they'd be like, too bad. Sorry. It's my right.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that's not much different. And it's uncomfortable for pro-gun people to come to terms with that, but that's not much different from people who are like, I just don't like guns. Whatever you say, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. I've heard pro-gun people say things like, because the argument is not made ingenuously, I understand the response. People, anti-gun, or I should say gun control supporters, have asked how many kids have to die before you're going to support gun control. And the response is all of them, because they're never going to support gun control.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize that part of the animosity, I think, in that answer, part of that answer comes from animosity for the person asking it, not because if that person's kid died, it would be hard to say that they wouldn't have some kind of, it wouldn't have some kind of effect on their views. You know, I think there is a logical conclusion when we believe that gun control doesn't work the way that it's supposed to work, that regardless of whatever law is on the books, things like that will still happen. But I also think it's not reasonable to say that if that was hitting closer to home, that they wouldn't have that wouldn't affect their perspective.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure where I was going with that. But
no, I mean, I think what it makes me think of is, you know, when I go into those kinds of conversations with people who are uneasy about guns, and they, you know, I'm the gun guy and a lot of the liberal groups that, you know, friend groups I'm in, and at least the out one, because there's a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of closeted liberal gun owners out there.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I have all of those, you know, the same dissertation that I can give, but, you know, I like to just begin by saying, like, so you're uneasy with guns. You know, why? Talk to me about, you know, how you came about this. Like, what do you think about when you think about guns? What makes you uneasy? And, you know, if you start by saying, oh yeah, you don't like the fact that people go in and kill children in elementary schools. Me either. Like, that's atrocious and that's awful. And we agree on that. And then, you know, have that as a basis, you know, that common basis as a starting point, and then figure out, okay, where at what point do we diverge, you know, and say like, yes, we want to make this harder to happen. What are your thoughts on how you can do that? Here's, you know, maybe why I think that won't, you know, have the success that you want. And you may get to that point where you say like, hey, you know, now we're at the point where we just can, you know, we have to agree to disagree. You know, maybe we disagree on the efficacy of law, the role of government, or where to draw the line between, you know, rights and negative outcomes, because it is the case that, you know, the right or the ability to do certain things comes with a certain amount of risk. And again, to get back to the alcohol or the driving, you know, that we accept there's a certain amount of risk involved in being able to do things that we want to do. So, you know, I think that that's a way to approach that. And, you know, if you, it might have saved you a couple hours if she would have just surfaced right at the start, like, this is why I hate guns and I'm never going to change my mind.
It was nice because I still enjoy hanging out with her. But yeah, if it was a stranger on the street, it'd be a, I'd probably feel like I wasted some time.
Yeah. And yeah, I also, when I'm, you know, kind of am getting ready to go on the road and hopefully have a chance to talk to people about my book and people who are not already bought into the gun idea, you know, I like to, you know, just start with, you know, everybody who's in favor of gun violence, you know, raise your hand, right? And, you know, hopefully there's, you know, nobody in there. Like, there's going to be some joker real who's like, as long as it's legitimate defensive violence, I'm for
it.
Yeah,
of course.
But, you know, that kind of surfaces from the start. It sets a tone of saying like, hey, wow, you know, regardless of our where we come from or where we think we should go with respect to guns, we have a lot in common, right? Nobody wants there to be negative outcomes with firearms, right? And people who are gun owners want responsibility. So, you know, that if we start there, maybe we, again, we're not going to end up all holding hands and singing Kumbaya, but at least we can kind of go away from it thinking like, here's where we can agree and here's the places we disagree. And, you know, it's how many million Americans are there? 340 million Americans,
something
very
like
diverse,
that.
You know, backgrounds. You know, why do we think that we're all going to agree on everything, right? The magic of the country is that we're all here on this one continent trying to get along, even though nobody's ever tried to do this in the history of humankind before on this scale, right? If you, you know, made all of Europe try to get along with each other as one nation, it would be havoc, right?
Yeah. No, absolutely. You mentioned that you're, before my goldfish fish brain forgets this, but you mentioned that you're going to be going around with your book. When is that happening and where are you going? If that's a list of places, feel free to, you know,
the book comes out really end of May, beginning of June, sort of a June 1st publication date. And so I have a book launch event at a bookstore, local bookstore here in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. But then I'm trying to set up other events in the state of North Carolina. And then my wife and I are getting in our car and we're driving to California and back. My family's in California. So
wow.
Mid-June to the end of July, you know, we'll be traversing the country and I'm trying to set up events at bookstores along the way. You know, the reality is that it's hard to get into bookstores generally. It's hard to get a book that's not about how guns are ruining America into a bookstore. You know, bookstores are really kind of liberal cultural gatekeeping organizations, you know, in the same way that the publishing industry is a liberal cultural gatekeeping organization in that narrow-minded sense of, you know, liberals are anti-gun. And so, you know, if my first round attempt to get into bookstores doesn't work, I'm going to be like, you know, hey, I'm going to be in Wichita, Kansas on June 20th. Who do I know there? Like, who wants to talk about guns? You know, public library, you know, gun club, you know, street corner. Like, I tried to take it to the people. But, you know, I really want to be in the context of a bookstore because you are more likely to get people who are not super comfortable with guns there. Whereas, you know, I could go to gun shows and gun ranges and sign books and I'm, you know, sort of preaching to the choir in a sense. And so really trying to find places, venues to talk across these differences is what's ideal. But as these things come together, I guess a little self-promotion. If you go to guncurious.com, that's kind of the repository of all information about the book and what's happening. There's an events page there. So as things come about either in the real world or virtually, like this podcast is on the events page. So every event that I'm doing either in real life or via podcast or other media will be there. So, you know, follow me also just on my regular social medias. I try to keep people abreast of where I'm going. And I also do solicit a lot of help. You know, it's helpful to know people who live in different parts of the country who are willing to help rally people to different events. You know, there's nothing worse than you know, telling a bookstore, hey, people care about this issue, and then you do a book reading and two people show up.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, I can imagine. That's got to be a buzzkill for sure.
Like, I promise, I'm really big on Instagram.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
People do listen to me.
Well, if you're ever in Connecticut, as much as I would love to drive down to North Carolina, we have a lot of events going on around that. Well, I think we have two events going on, but with a two-year-old and a wife who still loves me at home, I have to be realistic for now. Yeah.
Yes.
I have to be realistic as to the things that I can ask. And that's one of those things that I don't even know if I'm
That's the thing. Sometimes it does hurt to ask.
Of course.
Where like like the audacity of the question sometimes does elicit a certain response.
Absolutely.
Well, I wouldn't even ask someone that I, you know, have just met to come to North Carolina for something like that. Anyway,
we would do it, dude. We're crazy.
I feel like I've known you for longer than today, though, because I've been following you for.
Yeah, he's got a parasocial relationship with you that far outstrips the, you know, how long you've known him.
Yeah,
well, I will feel hurt in that case if you don't show up.
Hey, friends, we hope you like the show. I bet you're thinking to yourself right now, man, I love this show and these dudes so much. It's a shame I didn't have mentors like them when I was a child. Things could have turned out differently. But things can't be too bad because you're listening to the A Better Way to A podcast right now. If you like the show and want to support us, our Patreon is a great way to do that. When you become a patron, you get access to all of these sweet perks that come with it, like exclusive merch, discount codes, bonus content, and even access to our super secret Discord server. Plus, we'd appreciate the hell out of you even more than we do now. Money buys our love, and we are cheap dates. Anyway, go to patreon.com/abetterwaytoa or click the link in the show notes to check it out. All right, back to the show.
So I do want to backtrack a little bit. So you mentioned closeted liberal gun owners a couple times on this podcast, and it's got me thinking about how many people, especially around, big summer of protests, the George Floyd protests, and then the mind-numbing streak of black people murdered by cops. I say that subjectively, 'cause nobody was ever convicted. And I had a lot of friends, especially like minority friends, who were, you know, would self-identify as liberal, come to me and ask me about guns. And I think a lot of gun owners had this experience, and they bought guns and they practiced with guns and they have those guns still, but like their family doesn't know about them. A lot of their friends don't know about them and that they made these purchases, that they're now part of, tangentially on the outskirts of gun culture, but not free to participate in it because, you know, they'll face judgment in their own social circles. How many of these people do we know that maybe just don't talk about their guns?
I mean, empirically, there's no telling. So, you know, no one has ever tried to figure this sort of thing out. In part because there's so much negative orientation among scholars toward guns that's the kind of question that they don't want to know the answer to. But I think we can all, you know, tell our personal stories of knowing those people, you know, and I was a closeted liberal gun owner for a long time, even though I was out in the sense that I have a public blog and I talked about how I went around to shooting events and training classes and these sorts of things that a lot of people just assume like, oh, that's just research. You know, he's like doing that for purposes of research. And if people wanted to believe that, I was perfectly happy to let them think that because I was, you know, not always comfortable myself embracing this label of gun owner because of all of those negative associations that people in some cases rightly have for, you know, what gun owners are, you know, those, you know, when I was watching January 6th, I was like, great, you know, who's going to be there? The Proud Boys are going to be there, right? And the Oath Keepers are going to be there. And for a lot of people, that's the face of gun owners in America. So, it wasn't really until probably 2018 or 2019 that I really came out myself as, you know, publicly saying, yes, I'm a gun owner. Here's why I own a gun. And it was liberating, as those kind of moments often are. But the thing was, is as shortly after I did that, then there were all of these people at Wake Forest, you know, other faculty members who were like, oh, I'm a gun owner too. Or, you know,
yeah,
I've thought about, you know, I've been really interested in getting a rifle. Could you help me pick one? Or would you take me to the range? I'm really curious about guns. So, you know, that was when I noticed, you know, the number of people who were either gun owners or gun curious who would never talk to me about guns until they knew for certain, like, I was a safe person to talk to. Right. And, you know, it's, I should do this, but, you know, Wake Forest, we have stickers that we can put on our office doors that are like, we're a safe place. If you want to come talk about LGBTQ issues, you know, this is a safe space. I should have some sort of thing for like guns where I can put that on my office. Like, this is a safe place.
I'm not gonna record.
If you want to talk about guns, safe space right here. You know, and because we need to have more of this sort of out in the open, and the more, you know, and it's easy for me to say now because I'm out, but you know, if the more people who are openly non sort of Duck Dynasty traditional gun owners who let it be known, then this takes away some of the power of that idea that there is a particular face of gun ownership. And a lot of these people who acquired guns in the, you know, great gun buying spree of 2020 plus, you know, they are people who own guns, but they are not gun owners in any kind of identity sense.
Right.
Because they do try to keep it at an arm's distance.
Yeah. And that makes sense. Like you said, considering the optics that are attached, unfortunately, to what people think of a gun owner as. But I think you hit the nail on the head. I know we've mentioned this a few times now before, but having people recognizing that you are a safe place for them to go talk to, or a safe person to go talk to, because they already trust you, is huge. And gaining that trust is probably the most difficult thing for people to do. We actually posted, we made a post, I think, last year, and it's pinned on our Twitter right now, and it's ways to talk to people about guns when they disagree with you, and then parentheses says or anything else, and it's really just ways that I did research on ways to talk to people who disagree with you, and this stuff is all over psychology articles. I mean, it's free information to get anywhere, and a lot of it seems like common sense stuff until you realize how little of it people actually do when they're talking to each other nowadays. One of them is, you know, show empathy, like, acknowledge a person's feelings. That's huge. If somebody says, hey, I feel this way about this thing, and then you immediately say, well, that's bullshit, it's not true, they're going to immediately recoil and say, well, this guy isn't somebody that I can continue to have a productive conversation with. If somebody comes to you, what was another one? Anyway, it's on our Twitter. But a lot of it is just being a decent person and showing empathy and listening. And listening, active listening is what, you know, not just listening, coming up with a comeback, but listening and taking in what they're saying.
This liberal.
Yeah. And, you know, but it goes both ways too. It's not just for gun owners to use, but it's for people who don't own guns when they're talking to a gun owner about why they own guns. It's a very helpful tool. Maybe we'll have to repost it on the Instagram, but we have it pinned on our Twitter right now. And it is so tough sometimes to have those conversations with people who straight out of the gate are, you know, launching ad hominem attacks at you, are, you know, comparing you to this person or that person, saying you don't care. Like, I have a 2-year-old daughter, and one of the first things that I thought, unfortunately, when we signed her up for daycare, was how safe is this place? And not safe as in, like, are they CPR trained? In, you know, where are the entrances? Where are the exits? And when I walk in, they have a key fob entrance system. But it's glass doors. It's a glass vestibule area. And I'm thinking, well, what is this going to do?
Yeah.
You know, and I hate that I have those thoughts.
All the time.
Those are not thoughts that anyone wants to have, and to be immediately discredited because I own guns and say that I don't care about kids, totally, you know, it jumps over the fact that I am a father. I am a, you know, all these things that that we probably have in common and that I could connect with this person on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just, it's, I think if more people practice that, if more people practice listening rather than attacking and, you know, kind of coming straight out of the gate with these preconceived notions, because I'll even defend people that I don't agree with. I'll say, you know, I have people all the time in our inbox saying, well, conservatives are this, that, you know, they're might as well be Nazis. And I have to kind of be like, hey, you know, just because the ones you've spoken to identify themselves as this way or that way doesn't mean all conservatives are. I've met classically conservative people who hate the Proud Boys, who hate, you know, all this crazy stuff that's going on. And the same can be said about gun owners, non-gun owners. You know, we shouldn't draw conclusions based on biases we have and information that we don't have or that we think we have. But it is really hard to make headway in that area sometimes when you've got people immediately jumping down your throat.
Yeah. And yeah, as you fast forward to the end of my book, in the last paragraph, really, I talk about how it was only, you know, because I got involved with guns that I had so much interaction with people who were socially and politically different from me, because we live most of our personal and professional lives with people who are very much like us. So for me, it's, you know, like suburban liberal professionals who happen to be tend to be liberal. And so, you know, getting involved in guns, I wasn't red pilled, you know, I didn't somehow see the light, but it helped me see the humanity of people who I otherwise wouldn't have a lot of interaction with in everyday life. And, you know, we disagree on a lot of politics, but we can agree on a lot about our values, valuing family, valuing children, safety, having a better society, right? Different visions for how to achieve that. But at least if you, you know, can look at the people that you interact with as fellow citizens, and not the enemy, then I think, you know, you're in a more hopeful position for making some progress. And, you know, I think, you know, I drink and I have a car, right? It doesn't mean that I have to be an anti-drunk driving, advocate. But it does, you know, make me think like, hey, what can I do to make sure that I don't intersect those things in a negative way? And how can I encourage people in my sphere of influence, you know? And I think the same way, like no gun owner is responsible for being, a gun control advocate, but, you know, we know things about firearms and we can promote responsibility within our sphere of influence. And, you know, if some people want to take that further and get involved in gun violence prevention, it would be great for more gun owners to be involved in gun violence prevention.
David, have you ever thought about getting into politics? I'm sure you've been asked that once or twice before, because one thing that I'm constantly hoping for is for the wall to be dropped between liberal views and gun control. And because it seems like everyone who writes these laws has no clue what they're talking about. And I wish one of two things. One, that one of them would ask for advice or information, but politics is a shit show. Or for one of a self-professed Democrat in politics to be knowledgeable about guns. Yeah. and the data behind that. But I don't know how far you'd get in North Carolina, but actually, you know, I don't know. I feel like most people, I think you actually mentioned this in your book too, or something along the lines of how the majority of people kind of occupy the middle. I think people are yearning for people who truly represent them. And that's a huge problem with our current political system, is that it's so polarized. And I don't think most people fall to the far right or the far left, or what they consider to be the far right or the far left. I know we have some left-leaning comrades listening to us right now who are like, Biden is not far left. And I agree. But I don't think that there's anybody who truly represents us anymore. And I think that, you know, I wish we had more people like you with the nuanced views that you have, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the problem is our institutional politics don't privilege nuance anymore. I mean, it's so gerrymandered. No. You know, we're really divided up into safe blue districts and safe red districts. And so there's no need for nuance, right? That you just have to run to, you know, the more extreme part of your base. And North Carolina is gerrymandered terribly by the Republicans. And so, you know, there's no hope for sensitive to guns Democrat doing anything in the state of North Carolina, and you know, arguably any place in the United States, unfortunately. So that's why I sort of try to work with small P politics and, you know, try to influence people to get the word out as much as possible to say like, hey, you know, we don't have to buy into this polarization around guns just because our institutional politics does that. And I'm, you know, always, I'm happy to talk to anybody across the political spectrum. I'm actually, before my bookstore book launch, I'm going to be at the NRA meeting speaking to the National Firearms Law Seminar as the keynote lunch speaker. And, you know, there's a lot of people who are like, you know, that's disgusting. How are you going to go speak at an NRA event? And I'm like, because they invited me and because they're going to give me 45 minutes to say whatever I want. They don't have control over the editorial content of what I say. And I'm going to say what I actually believe, you know? And you know, I think that we need more of a willingness of people to speak across those boundaries, and also to emphasize what we agree with. I disagree with a lot of the NRA, and I agree with some of it.
Yeah, definitely.
Hell yeah.
Well,
nailed it.
Nailed it.
Let's stop then.
Well,
I don't want to keep talking and make myself look stupid.
Yeah, no. We have to stop it while he ended with something good. Everything you said was good though, man. I can't even joke about that. We appreciate the hell out of what you're doing and what you're trying to do, because it is. I mean, along with it being refreshing, I think it is truly needed in the to kind of, I don't know, save us from where we're going, if anything. I just, having nuanced conversations, save us, David.
Save us.
Please. But we need more nuanced conversations about things that we believe in, and we don't really have that. So the fact that you are doing that and doing that in an area where we are very passionate about, you know, thank you for all the work you've done. I know it's a ton of work, and, you know, we look forward to supporting you, continuing to support you in it. But, If you want to plug your book and whatever else you're working on, please feel free.
So now let me say, like, this is literally the first media that I've done about the book itself. You're one of the first people in the country who are reading the book. And, you know, I think
we feel honored.
That's comes from my, sense that you're doing the work, right? And I respect what you guys are doing. And, you know, again, this is the reason I'm here, is because I like and support the work that you guys are doing. So I'm happy to be here. This, you know, the book is Gun Curious, A Liberal Professor's Surprising Journey Inside America's Gun Culture, based on, I became a gun owner in 2011. I started studying guns in 2012. So the book is, you know, over a decade in the making, and is really written for a broad audience, you know, for people who are into guns. Hopefully you find it a fair representation of who you are. For people who are skeptical about guns, I try to challenge, you know, some of your views. And for people who are just curious about guns, hopefully you find some honesty in there about, you know, the reality of guns, the positive and also the negative, the risks of negative outcomes that are involved in guns. GunCurious.com is the easiest place to find information. Pre-orders of the book are really important, because I think my publisher doesn't have any idea of how much interest there is in this book. And I can say that 33 publishers passed on the book before my publisher took the book. Reason they passed on the book is because, you know, they don't feel like there's a big market for books about guns, and particularly not a book that doesn't take a 100% critical view of guns. Like, there's plenty of books being published all the time by big publishers that are about why guns are ruining the country. So there is a part of me that wants to prove those 33 publishers wrong. If you want to help me in that effort, then pre-ordering the book on Amazon or at your local bookstore, or if your finances are such that you can't buy the book, then ask your local library to order the book. That, you know, helps as well, because a lot of libraries won't carry books unless their members ask for it. So I appreciate the support. I appreciate the work that you guys are doing. I'm, you know, super excited to have this opportunity to be here.
Likewise, David. We, super happy that we were finally able to connect with you. I know we've had this planned for a little while now. I'm glad that we, I'm sorry, my water pump just turned on. I don't know if you hear that. Sorry. This was great. I think it is really going to be a refreshing take for a lot of people, regardless of what side that you fall on. I know I love the book, what I read of it so far. And if you're listening to this, go buy the book. Go pre-order the book.
It's going to be
fine. Support David.
You're not going to be disappointed. Just pre-order the book.
Just pre-order it.
Just get it.
Absolutely.
So right now, hold on. Wait. Let's just give him a minute. It should take about like 30 seconds. Just go. Before we end the podcast, I want to make sure you're opening the app.
They'll do it at the end.
David.
David, before we let you go, we have a tradition on this podcast. If you had a piece of advice to leave our listeners, it doesn't have to be gun related. It can be, but it could be about anything. What would that piece of advice be?
I mean, I think we just need to connect with other human beings in real life. It's kind of ironic to say on a podcast that you need to get out and talk to people out in your community. But, set the phone aside, go outside, touch grass, interact with real human beings, and pay attention to what's going on around you. And I think we'll find that we have a lot more in common than we have differences.
Can I get a hell yeah?
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah. David, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. This was great.
And yeah, this ruled.
We appreciate everything you're doing.
Thanks, guys.